Good afternoon and welcome to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. I'm Lindsay Maynard. Today's speaker is Governor Paul LePage. He recently spoke in Portland at the Cumberland Club as part of their Joshua Chamberlain Lecture Series. He spoke about his plans for Maine in the coming year and will discuss issues such as pension taxes, educational reform, and business growth in Maine. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at any time or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Penny Carson, president of the Cumberland Club.
Good evening. Could I have your attention, please? Thank you so much. This is a real pleasure to have this nice crowd here on the second of our Joshua Chamberlain Lecture Series for the fall. Our guest tonight is Governor Paul LePage, the 74th governor of the state of Maine. I wished I had gotten this piece of trivia first to tell you how many governors have actually belonged to the Cumberland Club in the 200 years that we've been here. Governor LePage is committed to creating a more business-friendly environment through reducing red tape in state government and improving customer service within state agencies. The governor will share his thoughts with us tonight about what he thinks is going to happen in Augusta moving forward from this point on. Please welcome to the Cumberland Club of Portland, Maine, Governor Paul LePage.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here. In fact, the last time I was here was, I was still running for governor, I believe. last year at this time, there was about, maybe about 16 months ago, there was about 24 people running for governor. This year is about 24 people running for mayor of Portland. I want to thank Penny, the president of the Cumberland Club, for inviting me this evening. It's a real pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be able to come out and speak to you about what we've done in the first session and where we think we're heading in the second session. I know where I'm heading, but there's some people upstairs that they have to agree with me. Being a governor is interesting change in one's life. There's some real ups and there's some real downs. In my case, media scrutiny and general public life has been somewhat of a challenge. Having been from the streets as a young age, I having people looking over my shoulder is a challenge, to say the least. But the up part and the interesting part of being governor is meeting the people of Maine, meeting people going around the entire state and getting ideas. Probably the most pleasant part of being governor is Saturday mornings. I've started Saturday mornings from 8 to 12. I go to the office and we have constituent hours. People can come in by making an appointment. They come in and we spend 15 minutes. And I will tell you, some of the best ideas that I have heard in this state are on Saturday mornings. It's unbelievable how that's taken off. In fact, they told me that we're booked until the first of the year on Saturdays. It's just incredible how it's taken off and how many great ideas that are coming through the governor's office. Of course, you know I'll take credit for all of them by the time it's over. One of the most difficult things of being a governor is developing the patience to deal with government, the speed of government, or the lack of speed. We have a young boy we adopted about 10 years ago, Devin, and my wife says there are three speeds in life. There is slow, slower, and Jamaican. Well, I've added one. There's slow, slower, Jamaican, and state government. Being in the private sector all my life You look at options, you select one, you make a decision, and you move on. And state government, you have the options, you discuss them and discuss them and discuss them. Then you get to a point where you can make a decision, but then you go upstairs to the third floor, and then they start all over again. And that can take a whole lot of time. But despite all that, the first session was, I would consider, reasonably successful. And I say reasonably successful because we did attack the red tape in the state, and we have made some many changes in how we approach the regulatory environment. Now, that is not to say, and we have not changed one regulation. That's not what we're there for. We're not interested in getting rid of good, solid, tough regulatory environment. It was never my case. It was never my intent. And it's not something we're going to do. What our interest is to get through the maze, to become more business-friendly, stakeholder-friendly. We have developed an office in the Department of Economic Community Development. We have five executives, and their jobs are simply this. You come to Augusta, you have an idea for a business, we assign you an account exec, and they get you the permits. They do the groundwork. We will be there to get through the maze of getting you the proper licensing and the proper permits that you need to do the work that you do, the business you want to start. And our role as a public servant is to get to the end line as quickly as possible at the least cost to you with the least amount of time to get you through the process. So that's really what the whole red tape regulatory environment's all about. Health insurance, we made some major changes. In fact, the changes that we've made, which we sort of designed behind a couple, you know, the states are the laboratories of our country. So we've gone to the states and looked at what's good in different states, and it's working, and we've designed it for Maine. The good news is it was passed. The bad news is it's going to be passed, but the full program won't be in effect until 2014. So when you just apply parts of it, then you don't see the benefit of it very quickly. The first part that's been introduced is actually one that is not very helpful to lowering rates because it's based on the geography and the small business. And so if you're up north and you have people that are in their 50s and they're using health care, it's a challenge. Now, when the reinsurance gets in, that takes over, and then the rates are going to go down. Some small businesses have seen some cuts in rates, but many have seen an increase because the whole program is not in place. Once it's in place, I assure you it's going to drop health insurance costs in the state of Maine. In fact, the Heritage Foundation is now looking at our program and trying to see if they can't use parts of it to challenge the Affordable Care Act at the federal level. Welfare, I'll be the first to admit that we've had very little change, very marginal improvements. We did manage to get a five-year limitation on lifetime limitation on welfare. We did manage to get drug testing for those who have been convicted of drug offenses if they're going to go on the system. There's so much more to be done. And out of all the programs and agencies in the state, the one I probably understand the best, having grown up through it, is the welfare system. And so we need to do a lot of work in that area. It's not an area where there's enormous amount of fraud in, as far as numbers, and I will concede that. But the numbers that are there are the most costly, and it's very, very expensive, and we have limited resources, so we have to be very diligent at solving that issue. Taxes, we had the largest tax cut in the history of the state. It was designed specifically for large business and small business. One, the state tax, we've increased it to $2 million. Would have loved to go to the federal level, didn't have the support upstairs to do it, so we've incrementally increased it to $2 million. We've increased the one-year investment for small business. You can write off up to $500,000 on equipment investment in the first year. That is a major improvement. For the larger businesses, we've allowed credits to be carried 20 years. We've allowed accelerated depreciation so that we can maintain and keep more cash flow in the hands of the businesses. Overall, the tax package reduced taxes by $400 million. Now, I'll be the first to say that many of the representatives in this part of the state have been very, very critical of me, saying that I've taken $400 million out of state government, the operation of state government. I am guilty as charged, because I look at it this way. I took $400 million and put it back in your pockets, where I really truly believe it belongs if we're going to grow the state. Government will never grow a state. They'll grow the ranks of government. The private sector is who grows an economy. And so I firmly believe that. So what are we looking for in January? My administration is going to be focused on jobs, jobs, jobs. But I, as governor, will not be creating jobs. I will create an environment so that you can create jobs. If I go out to create jobs, they're all going to be government jobs, and that's what I'm trying to shrink. So I admit I cannot create jobs, private sector jobs, as your governor, but I can create an environment, the regulatory environment. I can create a tax structure that you can invest and get your investment much quicker, your return on your investment quicker. So in January, I'm going after three major issues, and you're going to hear them over and over and over again until January. One is tax relief. The three items, the broad issues, are economy, education, and energy. In the economy, like I said, I can't create the jobs, but I can create an environment. So one of the things that I'm going to hope to do in January, and I've already been speaking about it in Augusta, and I just spoke about it a few minutes ago, and there was a couple of long faces that they were smiling when I got there, but they were long faced when I left because they're the opposition, and they're going to fight this. But I want to take the income tax off pensions, military pensions, and private pensions for every senior in the state of Maine. And the reason I think that's important is because I want to keep the seniors in Maine for a couple of two and three reasons. One, those who are paying tax usually have a pretty good nest egg. And to protect it against government, they move away for 6 months and a day. So they're contributing nothing to the economy during that period of time. I don't mind if they go away for January, February, because even I consider doing that, go south a little bit, warmer weather. But I want them here for 10 months to contribute to the economy, to keep their nest egg here, so maybe they will help some of the younger, innovative, creative people to finance some of these ventures that we're looking for. Maybe they can invest in small business and get further returns. I think that's very, very important. But most important is the intellectual wisdom that the seniors possess. We need them here to help us move the state forward. I would love nothing more than to have all the seniors make appointments to spend 15 minutes with me on Saturday morning because of the things that I've been learning, not only about life in Maine and business in different parts of the state, but the knowledge that seniors have to contribute and the ideas that come from people that have been there, done that. And that's very, very important. So I am going after a tax reduction. I'm going after job creation. We are going to continue the streamlining that we are currently doing. We have a mandate from the legislature to find $25 million for when they return in state cuts, in program cuts. Now, these are not cuts that are going to be laying people off. These are cuts that are looking to find efficiencies, duplications, redundancies in state government where we can eliminate it, put the limited resources into those areas in which we need. That's another area that we're going to be working on. And then in January, we start what is called zero-based budgeting going forward. Now, you talk about a challenge. I believe that everyone who runs in the legislature, runs for the legislature, and before they're sworn in, they ought to be required to take accounting, economics 101. And if they have time, then we'll give them an accounting course. But it is just amazing to me, standing and listening to arguments thrown at us that will absolutely make no economic sense. They won't balance. It just simply won't work. Because no matter what anybody says, at the end of the day, you gotta balance the checkbook. And this is one thing that we need to do as a state. We need to do as a culture, and we need to do as an attitude. We need to have the attitude that we can only spend as much as we have. And we can borrow a little bit if you can pay the interest and the principal. But in January last, the first thing that I heard is we need a bond issue. Okay, for what? First of all, what's the return on the bond issue? Where do you want to spend the money? I never heard, other than roads, which we can always spend more money on roads, most of the bond issues were feel-good spending. Just really good. It felt good to spend that money. It's like my wife going out for a sale. She really feels good. Don't know if she really needs it, but she really feels good because it was on sale at Martin's. So we're going to be looking at the economy. We're looking at the WIBs in the state. We're looking at different organizations that do workforce training. We are having some job conferences, summits this month. We've already had one at the Blaine House, a phenomenal day. I mean, so many great ideas from business people on what we can do that at a low cost to the state, but will make a big difference in how we work with the private sector and how the state reacts to issues facing our economy. Single largest problem state of Maine faces that hinders our ability to create jobs right now and to attract capital into the state. And I've spoken to some Japanese, South Koreans, large business owners in the country. The single one issue that keeps coming back up is the cost of energy. The cost of energy in the state of Maine is too high. We are the 12th highest cost of energy in the country. We pay, on average, 42% above the average American for electricity. 42%. Now, you've heard this week in Barber Foods, some of the jobs are going away because they're more competitive with energy. I had a discussion with Bucksport Mills on Monday, saying that they're shutting down a paper machine permanently. And in order to ever reactivate that machine, they need to spend $150 million on the machine to to convert it to a different product, because the product that they're making is a dying market. What they make is newspaper print. And newspapers is a dying market. Everything's going online, thank God. For me. No, they're good people. We just see things differently. So in January, we are going to really push hard on energy. Why are we 42% above the national average? State of Maine has the highest renewable portfolio in the country. We started in January at 34%. Legislature pushes it so that in 10 years it will be 44%. Increases 1% a year. The next closest to us is Massachusetts at 20%. And we can't compete with states like Wisconsin, Wyoming, Nevada, Nebraska, South Carolina, North Carolina, Kentucky, Tennessee. These are all states that are absolutely killing us with energy cost. So we need to get rid of the renewable portfolio. We need to reduce that. We have on your electricity bill every month 1.5 cents per kilowatt hour is for what is called stranded cost. Stranded cost, folks, is all the mistakes we made in the 80s and 90s we're paying for now. There's roughly $70 million that remains to be paid from now through 2018. I want to find ways to eliminate that. So I'm challenging CMP and Amira to sit down with us and figure out a way to get rid of stranded costs. 0.6 cents of your electricity bill is for add-ons that the state government puts on. You may not know this, but we have welfare programs that you're paying for through your electricity bill. We add a little bit here, a little bit there. Then we take it and we throw it in welfare because we ran out of money, so that we put it on the electricity bill. Nobody knows, nobody sees, and it gives us about $100 million a year. So we're going to try to get rid of that. There's about $400 million a year that you are paying more than the national average that need not be there. It's not for the generation of energy, and it's not for the transmission or distribution of energy. So we need to get that off your bills. And we need to get that out of on the commercial and industrial ratepayers' bills. I am for, and make no mistake about this, I am for any energy source that will help us build a prosperous economy. I'm not against any resources. I'm not against wind. I'm not against solar. I'm certainly not against tidal. I'm not against natural gas. But I'm against those that add cost to our electricity bills. That's what I'm against. Right now, they can build any wind farm they want in this state, and I'll help them build it. I just don't want to have to pay for the electricity. Sell it to somebody else. I'll help you. In fact, in January, I want to see how many Mainers truly want to pay the premium for green energy. So we're going to have a standard offer, traditional standard offer, and a green energy standard offer. And I'm anxious to see how many people step up to the plate and pay for the high-cost energy. Because if the majority do, then I'll back off and we'll go green all the way. But the problem with green is, when you hear about green energy, that means that the rate is going to be higher, and the federal government is going to be putting in a whole lot of it to just try to keep it down enough. Well, if you haven't heard, the federal government is cutting back. They are flat broke. And that means that next year, we're going to be losing a lot of subsidies. I know the ethanol subsidies are going to be attacked. The wind subsidies are going to be attacked. I know that welfare Medicaid is being cut by hundreds of millions of dollars that we have to make up. So what they're doing is, because they're so in debt, they have no money. They're passing back. They're not changing the statutes. They're just saying, well, it's going to have to be picked up by the states. We can't afford it. So there's going to be a big pushback. So the energies are going to be a big factor. Now, what's the solution? Major solution is natural gas. Right now, in the last 10 years, there's been some major discoveries in natural gas in this country. Right now, the estimates are that we have enough natural gas to run the nation for 100 years, number one. Number two, we have two major pipelines that come through the state of Maine. We just need to start using them more efficiently. We have one coming east-west and one that is sort of west-north, and then it comes back to Portland. So we are working with natural gas companies. We are working with the paper mills, for instance. The buyers for the mills in Millinocket have said, we need natural gas, so we're working with them. We're working with Woodland. They're putting in a pipeline. So they're solidifying their energy costs for the next decade. In 2000, natural gas sold for $5 a million BTUs. Oil was selling at $5 a million BTUs. Today, natural gas is selling at $5 a million BTUs. 11 years later, oil is at $15 a million BTUs. 80% of our homes are on oil. We need to get them off oil. We need to get them onto an alternative, which is natural gas, wood, pellets, other fuels that are less expensive than oil. We need to get off the whole kick of energy for our homes and for our electricity. We need to stop using oil because right now, it's needed in automobiles for transportation. So that's going to be a major issue. And the biggest one is going to be education. In the state of Maine right now, we face a 21% dropout rate of high school. 20% of every child that goes on to university, one in five, needs to take remedial work before they can start their college degree. 54% of the kids going into the community college system in Maine need remedial work. That means that we spend money on kids that after the ninth grade, they 21% drop through the system. Then we lose another 54% and 20% that go on to higher education that we have to spend money re-educating them a second time for things they should have known the first time. So what's the problem? Two problems. In the last 30 years, and you'll hear more about this. We've been doing a lot of research this summer. We've looked at the top 10 countries, the education systems in the top 10 countries in the world. The United States is currently 27th. The top 10 countries have a couple things in common. Number one, every teacher has to have subject matter knowledge before they can teach a subject. For instance, in Canada, to teach English, you have to have a degree in English. In the United States, in order to teach English, you need a teaching certificate. You need to be certified in teaching. We got to get out of that mentality. We have to make sure our teachers have subject matter. The other thing that Canada does and Finland does, they allow second careers. People that have had a career, they allow them to come back out, go into teaching. And they take on-the-job methods work. They work under what is called a master teacher for a year or so until they get the skills to teach in the classroom. We don't do that in this country. So these are things we've learned on the global basis. The other thing we've done in this country two things that we've done that have been really bad for our children. And the results show it, particularly in STEM education, science, math, technology, and engineering. What, 30 years ago, we removed vocational education and business education out of K through 12. When I was going to school, well, maybe 40 years ago. When I was in school, you could take a business path, you could take a vocational path, or you could take an academic path. Under No Child Left Behind, everyone is being taught to go the academic path, and everybody is taught to take SATs. We literally take our books and put them away for 2 or 3 weeks a year, and we teach our kids how to take a national exam. And we're failing. We're never going to run out of a need for plumbers, electricians, CAD operators, draftsmen, engineering. These are all things we need. So we're going to introduce vocational and technical back into our curriculum. We're going to introduce second career professionals into the teaching profession. I think it's critical. And the other thing we need to do is we've dumbed down our system because the top 20%, they get bored, and they're way ahead of everybody else, but we have to dumb them down to get the other 80%. And then the 20% at the bottom, they just fall out, period. They're the dropouts because we don't have time to teach them. So rather than have promotions by age group, or by years of K through 12, and you've been a year in the second grade, you move on, we're going to set standards. You need to meet a certain academic or vocational standard before you can move on. We eliminate the grade, and you stay there until you get it. Or we expand, and we will do this. It's not an or, it's and. We are going to expand by bringing in business and vocational and technical, along with academics. We're going to expand the choices kids have, occupational choices, directions, paths in life. And we're going to push those so kids can excel in some areas and maybe not others. I know that early on in life, I was told by my guidance counselor that the best thing I could do in life is learn how to paint. And it wasn't on a canvas. And so when I graduated from my bachelor's degree, I photocopied my degree, framed it, and sent it to my guidance counselor. And after I got my master's degree, I photocopied it, framed it, and sent it to my guidance counselor. And I ran into him one day, or maybe 15 years ago, and he said, "Paul, don't tell me you're getting your PhD. I don't want to do it." We all make mistakes. So the point is we need to broaden the scope of curriculum so kids can find an area of interest and they can excel in it. And that's where we're going with education. We believe that attacking energy, keeping our brightest and best here in the state, which is our seniors who have been through the trenches and been through the wars of life and have accumulated a lot of wisdom, that we keep them here to pass it on to our younger folks. That, along with a much stronger education, lowering the energy costs, that I believe the people from Japan, for instance, we had a meeting with the General Council of Japan, and they're going around the world now looking for countries and areas that they can put particularly automobile plants, parts, automobile plants to do parts for their automobile industry because of the tsunami and the nuclear reactor. They have been caught flat-footed. Too much of their plants are in Japan, and they're now operating at half pace, and they can't help the auto industry. They are hurting. They're looking to have places to put plants. The Japanese have three plants in Maine through the name of another company. They make small parts. And what they've told me is, I visited these plants before I came to see you, Governor. And I would love to tell you that I'm going to put a fourth plant here or that we're going to invest in Maine, but we can't afford your energy. So that's basically where we're heading next year. I will stop now and let you ask questions. And if you don't have any, I'll go home. You can have dinner. And if you have any, you'll have to wait for dinner.
Thank you very much, Governor. That was excellent.
Thank you.
Excellent. I really enjoyed it. Thank you. We have quite a few questions here. I wanted to say that we are on public radio, and this will be repeated on public radio. And that being the case, I will now remember to introduce myself as Penny Carson, and I am the current president of the Cumberland Club. I also want to say one other thing. Having been born and raised in Maine, I wrote down two notes while you were speaking. One is that the way we speak in Maine, which is so refreshing to hear the governor, because I have ideas, and we live in Augusta. And I personally like that very much.
You're lucky I don't go into the French.
Well, we do have some questions here. Will drug testing for Maine care ever be required?
Very interesting. Very good question. In January last, we were able to get drug testing for all welfare recipients that have had a drug problem. We tried to get everyone on welfare to be drug tested. The legislature denied us. I am going back at it in January. You can all help. If you believe in that, you can call your legislature and your senator and tell them there's nothing wrong with drug testing. Truck drivers have to do it. Equipment operators have to do it. Anytime you have a job that could create a safety hazard for others, you have to do it. I maintain that if we drug tested everybody that's on welfare, one of two things is going to happen. Drug use is going to drop, or welfare costs are going to drop.
My voice carries well, okay. Tolls on turnpikes were supposed to be eliminated when it was paid for. Any chance that will happen?
You know, you're so right, and that is one of the biggest gripes I've ever had about the Turnpike Authority, is they said back in the 50s, and believe, well, I do remember that. I do remember when they were saying that. They said that once the bonds were paid for, they would eliminate the tolls. I don't know if you know this, but the legislature is the one that kept it alive. They were ready to do that back in 1984, and the legislature gave them a mandate to continue to raise tolls to do the maintenance on the turnpike. I would absolutely love to roll it into the DOT, but I will tell you, it's going to be a battle to get energy costs down. That one there is going to have to wait till the third year of my administration.
Do you think there's any chance that we can reduce or consolidate towns and cities like we've tried to do with schools?
Well, the way we did it with schools has probably not been a great thing. It's not worked very well, but there are some great opportunities. The answer to that question is yes. In fact, I have put in $63 million into the GPA funding. We are going to ask the legislature in January to give us maybe $5 or $10 million of that. I'm also going to ask the legislature to give me $5 or $10 million set aside into special accounts for revenue sharing with communities. And the whole purpose is to use it as incentives to get communities to put together plans to work together. And having been a mayor, that question is incredibly timely. We asked the town of Winslow, back when I was mayor of Waterville, to share a grader, road grader. We only use it 40 hours a year, so let's share. You know, well, if you want it first, you can have it first. We'll use it after you. Couldn't get it done. We bought a ladder truck, 100-foot ladder truck. The reason it's a 100-foot ladder truck, because there were two buildings. the Colby Library and the Mercer Building in the city of Waterville required 100 feet. So we bought it. We went to them and said, you want to go in half on it? Nope. We don't want to be involved in a 100-foot ladder. The very next year, they bought a 75-foot ladder. Neither one of them, to my knowledge, has ever been used simultaneously. So the answer is, I really believe, having been a mayor, there are opportunities. We did succeed in getting the town of Winslow and the city of Waterville to share a fire chief. There's so much more of that that could be done, particularly in public works, in fire and police, in public safety, and tax assessing and those type of things. There are many areas that we can reduce the cost. This is the problem. Home rule. Home rule is something we have in the state of Maine. It's very, very costly. Until the people of Maine decide that we'd rather save tax dollars over home rule, it's going to be difficult.
Thank you. Would Maine ever compete with New Hampshire in the retail liquor business?
Yes. It's interesting you bring that up because I had a long discussion this morning about liquor sales in the state of Maine. There are two or three things we need to do. One is we have a contract that's going to end in 2 years. We need to renegotiate it. I believe that if we are smart, we will negotiate a 10-year contract, but have the revenue spread over 10 years and not take it all the first year and blow it like we did last term. I think that was a mistake. I think we need to look at, and I've asked, there's an analysis going on right now. What happens if we drop the taxes 10% on liquor? What happens if we drop the taxes 20% on liquor? What happens to volume? Now, we need to, if you're interested in competing with New Hampshire, raising them is not an option. Because right now, the majority of establishments in Maine buy their liquor in New Hampshire because it's cheaper. It's cheaper because the taxes are cheaper. The liquor is about the same price. You might have a little differential in transportation. It's all about what do you want. Do you want to sell more liquor or less liquor? Do you want more revenue or less revenue? You want temperance? Very simple. Let's double the taxes. And then we won't sell any in Maine. We'll sell it all out of New Hampshire. The issue is economics. It is an economic issue. And so we are looking at it. I would like nothing more than to see tourism get a shot in the arm relative to being able to be more competitive here in the state of Maine. Because the liquor is being bought, whether it's being bought here. Well, we do have an advantage. Mainers buy liquor in New Hampshire. New Brunswickers buy liquor in Maine. But there's 1.3 million in New Hampshire. Yeah, 1.3 million in Maine who buy in New Hampshire. There's only 600,000 in New Brunswick. So that's another issue we have to contend with.
If the Biddeford Downs Racino passes, do you think you might veto it?
No. I don't have any authority to veto it because it's going to referendum. So whatever the people say is what will happen.
Okay. Do you happen to know, this is kind of tough to ask you right off the top, but how much will exempting retirement from income tax cost, and where will the money come from for the budget?
It's going to cost $96 million. It's going to come in zero-based budgeting. And it's going to be tapered in over 3 or 4 years as the economy grows. So that's what we're looking for. I will tell you one other thing that I wanted to mention earlier. There's a senator here in town, and I don't mind saying his name. It's in print. It's public. Senator Justin Alphon says that the governor has squandered $100 million since he took office in January. So I made the point to call Solomon Millett, the commissioner of DAS, of financial department, and asked him how much money was in the rainy day fund on January 5th, 2011. He said, that's easy. Hasn't been money there for years. I will tell you that today, as I speak, there was $71,500,000 in the rainy day fund, that we've accomplished that in 9 months.
There are many questions here. You see me shuffling them. Some of them he has actually spoken at length already this evening, so I would like to try to get to the different ones. So if you see me shuffling, that's why I'm doing it. It says, Governor, given the great percentage of state expenditures on health care, particularly MaineCare, is your administration considering moving from fee-for-service to a managed care platform?
Absolutely. In fact, that is currently under evaluation. We are working with the hospitals, and we are looking to bring the entire system to a managed care program. I think that it's high time. We are working with the hospitals to reduce the usage in the ERs and to assign people on MaineCare and Medicaid and Medicare a primary care physician if they don't have one. Over 80% of the physicians, private care, general practice physicians, family physicians are currently understaffed at our hospitals. Very few have private practices any longer. So it's a lot easier to have the assignment done right at the ER the first time they come in. If they come in a second time and don't use primary care physician, our plan is to charge them a copay. So if you go to the primary care physician, it's free. If you go to ER, you better bring some money.
This is the last question we have time for. The governor is moving on to a 6:15 departure time. Please give an example of any ideas that you have received. Ideas that you have received in any of the Saturday morning sessions that you think were particularly interesting.
You can think. Oh, yeah. I'll give you one right now. I'll give you two real quick. One's in the fishing industry, and one is in the logging industry. In the fishing industry, Maine fishermen come to dock. They sell their lobsters right off the boat. No high grading being done. We are losing $1 a pound at the boat because we don't go A grade, B grade, and then processing grade. We sell everything as processing grade at $3 a pound, where we could be getting $4 a pound if we earmark it for retail. We're looking into that. In fact, I met with some lobstermen yesterday, and they said, what an idea, but who's going to do it? Who's going to implement it? So we are going to attack that issue. Second issue, in the state of Maine, we have what is called tree growth. For people that have large parcels of land, they get a big benefit. Right now, as we speak, I have three sawmills and one paper mill going into the winter month and can't buy raw material. Can't buy raw material. And we have a tree growth tax that says if you have a sustainable forest, we will give you a tax break. So we give them a tax break. And I'm not being critical of all the landowners. Believe me, I'm just generalizing here. I'm just generalizing to the problem. So they pay less in taxes. So they look, the free market, which is the way to go, looks for the highest payer for the logs. Who's the highest payer for the logs? The people that pay the least amount for energy and the people that have subsidies on their capital expenditures so that they have more cash, they're flusher, to buy the logs. So where do the quality logs go? Canada. And our mills are not having enough wood. Now, that's not saying that all of them, but I will tell you right now, I've been having calls from paper mills, I've been having discussions with sawmills, and I've had discussions with veneer mills. They can't get enough resource off the land. Now, the state of Maine has more trees in the forest than we've had since 1955. The state of Maine is 93% forest. is a land base. So we have the fiber, but we're not getting it to our mills. And we need to find a mechanism to do that. And so I will be working very hard in the next couple of months with the industry to get them to provide the resources necessary to keep our mills going. If not, and if we're not successful, then I'll have no options but to address it with the legislature in January.
Thank you, Governor, very much.
It is my pleasure.
I did really enjoy that.
Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed everything you said.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. Today's speaker was Governor Paul LePage. Governor LePage recently spoke at the Cumberland Club in Portland about his plans for Maine in the coming year. Charles Beck is the executive producer of this series. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Lindsay Maynard.